Station number 12439.
Rail 7.
Yes, they were well treated. We didn't really hate them because we never had to fight against them. We were fighting against the Germans, and so we were fresh troops out there just to handle them as prisoners of war. So that we exercised them in the exercise yards. We took them out to as work parties to clean up Singapore, and they were happy enough to work under us. In fact, they saluted us officers whenever we came near them. A little squeak would come from somebody, and another squeak, and all heads and eyes would stare at you until you gave them a signal for them to carry on working. So they corrected, or they behaved very well, and I think they were calmly waiting for the day to be returned back to to their country. Quite an interesting incident, though. The senior officer that I had in the condemned block was a naval admiral, Japanese admiral, and he had been condemned to death for an action of dumping prisoners on the Aleutian Islands, some, and just leaving them there to starve to death. That's what I heard. But anyway, because of this atrocity, he had been found guilty and condemned to death. But then he said through an interpreter that he had the right to be shot rather than hung because he had been awarded a British decoration in the First Great War, and that he felt that he should be allowed to be shot in a more dignified manner. So we naturally said we knew nothing about this, but we'd check up with the Admiralty back in London and find out if this is the case and all that. And the days and the weeks went by, and he got a bit impatient after a time, waiting and waiting. We told him that no news had come through. So in the end, he said, "Oh, well, you might as well hang me now. It's about time I joined my ancestors. I'm tired of waiting. But please, will you bury me with a picture of my family, a photograph of my family? You can take anything else you like from my possessions." So we said that this could be arranged. And it was arranged, so he was hung. So anyway, that was our job there, and fortunately, it was interesting while it lasted, but it didn't last all that long. For about a month again, and then we were on the high seas. We were returning to rejoin the 6th Airborne Div in Palestine. Because of the atomic bombs and the Japanese war was over, we were kept out in Malaya and Java and Singapore because we had fresh troops, reinforcements. We had a job of work to do. But the rest of the division were diverted to Palestine. And the brigade gap we made in the 6th Airborne Div out there were filled up by the elements of the 1st Airborne Div parachutists who had survived Arnhem and had regrouped, and they'd regrouped into the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd battalions, and they came out to Palestine as a brigade to take our place, whilst we were now an independent brigade group out in the Far East. So when we came back to Palestine, there was no room for us in the division, and so regrettably we were disbanded. Rather a sad day. We were treated very well, the planning was well done. Every soldier could choose which battalion he would like to join if he had any friends in any of the other battalions. They could go with their friends, and that was all arranged. And I went to the 3rd Parachute Battalion. But the actual day of disbandment, we were paraded on the parade ground in our tented camp, I remember, a fully fledged parachute battalion, CO, battalion headquarters, support company, the three rifle companies, in full kit, and there was and our baggage and alongside the parade ground were the convoys of vehicles to take us to our various new battalions.
When was this that it was disbanded?
In Palestine.
When?
When we came back. Where?
When?
Well, wait a minute. 1946 it was, I think. 1946. We had Christmas early 46, after we finished with Java. VJ Day was 45, wasn't it?
August 45.
August 45. So we were out there during the Christmas of 45. Now we come to 46 and we do Java and the prison of Kalyan transit camp. No, I'm sorry. We
Changi.
Do Changi. And that's now early in 46. So about mid-46 we come back, May, June 46, to Palestine.
So you didn't see any of the troubles in Palestine?
A bit of it. Oh, yes. I missed the blowing up of the David Hotel.
King David Hotel.
Yeah. But we came when the troubles were there. But anyway, there we were on the parade ground, a farewell address by a commanding officer. And he said, to your respective unit transport, 12th Parish Battalion, dismiss. So we did a smart salute and turned to the right, and we all dispersed in our various groups to the lorries, which took us off to our new battalions. And within 10 minutes, the parade ground was empty.
Could I just deal with one thing later in your career, which was the Suez Crisis?
Yes.
Can you tell me what your personal memories of that, please?
Yes, I wasn't in Airborne at the time. I was back in my own regiment. This was 1956.
Six.
Now, I was back in my regiment now. I'd finished with the Airborne in 47. Came back from Palestine, from the 3rd Battalion, back to Airborne Forces Depot, training NCOs as a company commander, NCOs cadre, and also P Company, the parachute training company, for a time. And then many of us were told that we had a good innings in the parachute regiment and that we were to return back to our parent regiment. So I returned back to the York and Lancasters, okay, to my own regiment. And now this is quite a jump, isn't it, from going back 47. We're now jumping to 56.
Yes.
You'd like me to jump to 56
Please.
Now? Right. Now, our battalion, the 1st York and Lancasters, had been at Khartoum and in the canal zone, and we were thinning out and evacuating the canal zone, British forces, and the battalion was now back in Dover Castle with an infantry brigade in Dover Castle. And the Suez operation was mounted with the paras dropping on the airfield at El Gamal, and we, the brigade, Dover Castle, were suddenly told that we were going to be whipped out to the canal zone. I had the whole of my company at that time on leave, scattered all over Yorkshire. We were in a phase of each company having a leave one after the other. And I was rung up as we were going to bed, 10 o'clock in the evening. The adjutant said, John, you've got to get your company back here by midday tomorrow. And I said, good heavens, how can I? They're all over Yorkshire on leave. So I said, I don't believe it. It's an impossible order. So I said, I want to speak to the CO. So I rang up the CO and he says, yes, I'm afraid it is. We've got an operation on and it's immediate, important. So I wondered, well, how on earth am I going to get them back? So anyway, I spent that night having grouped all the leave passes in their towns, Sheffield, Middlesbrough, Hull, Grimsby and so on. I rang up the police of all those towns, one after the other, told them that this was an operational urgency and please could they wake up these soldiers in their dresses and get them down to the station to catch the first train possible down to Dover. And this is what the Yorkshire police did. Without very willingly and very helpfully, all the Sheffield lot, all the police cars were out very busy getting York and Langstall chaps down, and I got them in. We travelled overnight, and I got the bulk of them in. And so we went by train from Dover to Southampton, and the whole brigade was put into a whacking great emigrant ship. It was called the New Australia, that we're taking emigrants out to Australia. And this ship sailed to the Mediterranean. We were on it for the canals then, for Suez. We stopped at Valletta on the way, and our CO and intelligence officers went ashore for briefing and then came aboard again, and we carried on with our journey. And we were told that plans had changed. The idea, first of all, was for us to land at Alexandria and go straight for Cairo on the pretext of protecting British personnel and property at Cairo and so on. But we weren't to do that. This is what we're told, whether it's right or not. But we were now to sail to Port Said to reinforce or to relieve the Paris. And this was due to the Americans. We had an American naval ship making quite sure that we weren't going to go anywhere else but to Port Said and not to Alexandria. So our troop ship with a whole brigade aboard sailed into Port Said harbour, and the brigadier went ashore and spoke to General Stockwell, who was commanding there, and said, "Look here, I've come with a brigade. Where do you want us?" And the story goes that Stockwell knew nothing about us coming, but no matter. He said, "Come ashore." And so we did. The York and Langstalls were first off the ship, and A Company was leading. I was company commander. And my orders was to march as quickly as possible to El Gamal airfield and take over from the 3rd Para Battalion that had landed and had were in occupation of the airfield. So this I did. And we started marching through the streets, the harbour area. And then suddenly I saw paras and people around me putting on their steel helmets and getting into little holes around the road. And I wondered what else was happening. And then a little soldier from behind, a messenger from battalion quarters, running up and saying, "Air raid warning red." And I thought to myself, well, what do we do now, air raid warning red? Am I to stop or what? So anyway, I decided not to stop. I thought that the faster I can get away from the dock area and the port area, the better, if airstrikes were coming in. So I went on marching, and the battalion came on marching behind me. And it was a threat from aircraft from Syria, who were destined to were coming along, a serious threat of the enemy, of the support from Syria. Anyway, went on marching, got to El Gamal airfield, and I was mixing up with my old battalion of Palestine. We took over their positions, their quarters, and they withdrew back to Cyprus again to get ready for another airborne operation if necessary in the canal zone. Well, we stayed on the canal zone. We took it in turns. The airborne didn't get quite onto the firm land, the proper land of Egypt. There was the causeway from Port Said, with the river and the canal and the road running parallel to each other, with salt marshes on either side, until you get to the main land of Egypt. And the paras just got short of getting onto the main land. So, and each battalion of our brigade took it in turns to occupy the front line positions, which was only on a platoon frontage, just across the strip. And so we had a whole corps mounting up for an advance, if necessary, on a platoon frontage further down the canal. And I had an interesting time there, in that the York and Langstalls were holding this front on this narrow frontage when the United Nations troops came. And I was a company commander with my lads in trenches, and I had trenches on a very narrow front. And I was approached one day from the other side, the Egyptian side, by a fellow in a blue beret who was a Canadian engineer, Royal Engineers. And he told me, we're coming here, United Nations troops are coming here to take over your positions, and we're going to take over the Egyptian front line as well. And he says, have you laid any mines around the place? So I said, no, of course not. We are ready to advance if the Egyptians start firing at us and not conform to the ceasefire arrangements. We are ready to advance. We've got no mines around here. So he said, thank the Lord for that. So I just come from the Egyptian areas, and they've thrown mines all over the place. It's going to be a hell of a task to find them, lift them up. So he was rather relieved at that. And then the day came when the United Nations troops, the Danes, were due to relieve me from my forward positions. And they were coming in from the Egyptian side by train. And I was told to get ready to evacuate my position to withdraw by 0800 hours on this particular morning. And I was all ready, lads all packed up, weapons all clean, ready to move out back. And the train stopped at the Egyptian front line and didn't budge. And I wondered what in the hell was happening. And we just stood, sat there, and nothing happened for the whole of the whole of that day until the evening. When the train moved and came into no man's land. But before that, I had an interview, BBC fellow called Robin Day, with his television cameraman. He came up, surprised to me, he came up to me and he said, I'm Robin Day, are you commanding the frontline positions? So I said, yes. So he said, I'd like to interview you and ask you what's been happening today. And I had found out why all this delay was. I said, okay. I hadn't been on any course how to talk to press reporters or anything like that. And what to be honest, I said, okay, I will. I found out a bit of Jen. Apparently what has happened, that the Egyptians have refused to hand over their frontline positions to United Nations troops. We're quite happy to hand over ours. And the officer in command of the Danish troops doesn't know what to do, and has been trying to contact General Burns, who was OC, commanding the United Nations troops, to find out what he should do next, as the Egyptians were refusing to hand over their frontline position. And General Burns apparently had been swanning around in the desert at the back somewhere, out of touch, and nobody could get into touch with him. But eventually, they did. And this was when the Danes moved. And General Burns was put into the picture about the Egyptians, and he must have said to the Danes, well, to hell with the Egyptians, let them stay where they are, get your chaps into no man's land, take over the British positions and face outwards. And so the Danish officer got this orders, and so the train came in towards us and stopped in front of us, and Danish troops debouched out of the railway carriages, and up went a bloody great flagpole, flying the United Nations flag in the middle of no man's land, and some Danish troops came up to me and said, we're here to take over your positions. So I said, right you are, we've been waiting for you for the last 12 hours, you can take over these positions with pleasure. And we got out of it, we went back, and we went back to Port Said, the battalion went back to Port Said. And in a few days, we were on HMS, an aircraft carrier, that took us to Valletta. And when we got off the aircraft carrier into a troop ship, back to England.
How did you feel about going out for the Suez Crisis and also being pulled out again?
Well, my personal feelings is that we were doing a good job, that it was like the Falklands almost, you know. Why should we knuckle down to a tyrant who has robbed us of an international canal by the point of the bayonet, have confiscated our British property in the canal zone, taken over British factories and offices, hounded British people back with only a suitcase back to England. And how can we possibly allow a fellow like him to get away with it? I feel very much as like the Falklands. And so after a lot of arguing and talking through Menzies and so on, the time has come when we take action, as we said we were going to. So I personally was in favour of it. And I had a very young company. There were only a handful of regular soldiers in my company. I and my sergeant major, my platoon commanders were all national servicemen. The bulk of my lads were all national servicemen, very young. And we had to train them on ship for war. It's not an exercise that when they're on duty, they have a rifle with a bullet up the spout, and they've got to keep their eyes open. You know, this was the real thing. Prepare them that for being alert in case an Arab comes up and sticks you in the back in the middle of the night with a dagger. Anyway, all that was done. But I felt that we had brought in United Nations troops. Although we didn't get Nasser, and although we didn't defeat the Egyptians there, we did to the world a great service, this is my humble opinion, in that we alerted the world to how much Egypt was involved with Russia. The equipment that they had, their weaponry, their tanks, their anti-tank guns, it was all Russia. The stores that they had were all Russian. And I feel sure that if we didn't have the United Nations troops there, Russia in due course of time would have come across into Egypt with the intention of taking over Africa, the whole of that continent. Who can tell? A very good stepping stone if Egypt is right under the thumbs of the Russians.
But did you feel annoyed about having to come out?
No, not in a way. I didn't know. The whole thing had fizzled out. The Americans were laying down the law. We had landed. We had successfully shown how we could capture Portside without very many casualties. We gave the Egyptians in that area a bloody nose, and they were very frightened of us. We the British, weren't allowed to do anything more than what we did. The cry of halt, no further, came from the world, from America and the United Nations, and so we were obliged to do that. But I was very pleased that the United Nations troops came in, because they became the buffer between Russia and their advance into Egypt and onwards into Africa, and we alerted the world to how very involved the Russians were in the building up of supplies and armament.